Dr. Matthew Potter, curator of Limerick Museum, once again, you're very welcome along to join us here. We're socially distanced, I think, enough, by about 25 miles or thereabouts. I'm here, of course, in the markets field, and you're out in the lovely pastures of Limerick County. So wonderful to have you with us this evening.
Thank you.
We're going to have a look, I think, today, Matthew, at a number of items that lead quite nicely into each other. We'll start off and we'll have a look at Stadia, and the development of Stadia all the way back, I suppose, to the Greeks and the Romans. Times. We'll take that into the development of the GEA, and I suppose the GEA as a force from its very beginnings. And then we'll look at a son of Limerick who had a major impact in terms of the GEA and in terms of the development of one of its primary stadia, in fact, its only primary stadia, which is, of course, Croke Park. So, Matthew, I suppose looking back, stadiums have been with us for as long as modern history, I suppose.
They have. The Greeks invented the sports stadium, just like they invented so many other things. They invented democracy, they invented philosophy, they invented science, and they also invented the sports stadium. And they invented the first type of sports stadium, which was the circus. Now, we tend to regard the circus as being a circular structure, but the circus in the Greek world was horseshoe shaped. And they were comparatively small in scale until the Romans then took over the whole concept of the sports stadium. And then they developed the circus into the huge Circus Maximus, for example, where the chariot races were held, which was in the city of Rome itself and remains to this day the largest stadium ever constructed. At its height, it could hold 400,000 people. If you think the largest stadium in the world today is in North Korea, it can hold 150,000. And there was one in Prague at one stage, the Strahov Stadium, that held 240,000. That was in the 30s, 40s, 50s. So the Circus Maximus remained the largest stadium ever. And then, of course, there were similar circuses all over the Roman Empire. Then the Romans also invented the amphitheatre, which was oval or round-shaped. And, of course, the most famous example of that is the Colosseum. And the division of labour really was the amphitheatre. The Colosseum was used for gladiatorial contests, the ultimate blood sport, of course, where human blood was spilt in large amounts. And then the circus was horseshoe shaped and was used for chariot racing for the most part. And of course, then it's interesting how the terms we use for cinemas and for other public venues are still used. Were derived from the Romans and the Greeks. For example, the hippodrome was specifically used for horse races because hippos is the Greek word for horse. There was a famous hippodrome in Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. So all the hippodromes all over the world are derived from that. And likewise, the Colosseum, of course, gave its name as well to cinemas and to all sorts of public venues. But then, of course, following the fall of the Roman Empire, then there was a very long period of about 1400 years when there were no public stadia because no other civilization developed public events until the Western world began to industrialize in the late 18th, early 19th century. And this time it was Britain that took the lead. And the first modern sports venue was actually a large cricket ground in London, opened in 1814. And when you think about it, it was the elite sports that first got their own venues, such as, for example, the first modern racetrack was at Ascot. The first modern cricket ground, was at Lords in London. Then you had the development of Wimbledon, originally for croquet in 1868, and then later, of course, more famously for tennis. It was much later on then that soccer came into its own. The world's first purpose-built soccer stadium was Goodison Park, the home ground of Everton, in Liverpool, which was opened in 1892. And of course, then a few years later, with the first Olympic Games of 1896, the old-style Greek and Roman venues were revived. And for example, you had the Panhellenic Stadium in Athens, a white city in London. And of course, then in the meantime, of course, in America, there was the development of a whole range of public stadia for baseball, and for American football. So it's in that context then that Cope Park came was developed as the flagship stadium of the GAA. And it's interesting to note that if you think that 1892 Goodison Park was opened for Everton, its capacity was only around 10,000. Whereas then, when Cope Park opened in 1913, and I'm just going a bit ahead of myself here, its capacity was not that much less. So here you had professional soccer clubs in the richest country in the world, Britain, being developed by commercial soccer clubs. But here in Ireland, then, you had the GAA, a voluntary organisation dependent on the contributions of its members and so on. And it was already in a position to develop a substantial stadium in Dublin.
Let's go back then to the foundations of the GAA, and I suppose that's where we need to start with this next part of the story, which is the purchase of the ground at Jones's Road, yes. and the way in which that came about. But yes. The foundations of the GAA go back to the early 1880s, of course, and to that famous meeting that everybody knows about in Thurles, and the development of that through Archbishop Croke, Michael Davitt, and the others. But out of that, then, I suppose, clubs started to appear around the country, isn't that correct?
They did. And actually, there's a very good book called it's a history of the first All-Ireland final. And it was written by Paul Rouse, who's one of the foremost sports historians of the country. And he describes how in 1887, the first All-Ireland football final and the first All-Ireland hurling final were held. As you say, the GAA was founded in 1884. In 1886, the decision was made to set up county boards. In 1887, the Limerick County Board was established, and most of the other county boards. And now also in 1887, the first All-Ireland football and hurling finals, or championships, were set up. This then stimulated a great many clubs to be founded, because if you had your county boards, and if you had your championships, that then led to a lot of clubs being founded. And if you look at the clubs around Limerick, for example, a great many of them have as their official foundation date 1884, 1885, 1886, 1887, that whole period. And you can see how the beginnings of the GAA, the putting in place of the structures, was very important. Now, of course, what tended to happen then was there were several major controversies in the GAA in the late 1880s, early 1890s. Very succinctly, I can say that the two rows were, one, the Fenians, the Irish Republican Brotherhoods versus the Catholic Church. That was one huge row that went on for years. The second row then, which was not unconnected with that, in fact, it was close connected with it, was 1891, the Parnell split. And that led to county boards collapsing and clubs collapsing all over the place. And in fact, in County Limerick, for example, there were two county boards at one stage, one controlled by the Fenians, one controlled by the church. Later on then, there were different factions in Limerick GAA and in GAA all over the country, pro and anti-Parnell. And it wasn't then until about 1894 then that all of this began to pass and the GAA began to get back on its feet again. And the Limerick County Board was refounded at this time, and it continues to the present day. The same thing happened with clubs. They were caught up in these rows as well. But more prosaically then, down through the decades, sometimes clubs just simply ran out of steam. For example, Bury GAA. Now, my family, the Potters, were heavily involved with Bury GAA, the cousins of mine. But it was founded in 1895. It continued on to about 1940. It then disappeared until about 1945. And then it was established again, and it continues to present. Likewise, Ballybrown, where I grew up, where my particular branch of the Potters have lived in Ballybrown for over 200 years. Games were played in Ballybrown from the 1880s, 1890s. There was different names, different clubs. It's difficult to know when the present modern Ballybrown GAA club really got started. It seems to have had a continuous existence since about 1945. But before that, there were different clubs, there were different teams. There was a team, for example, in the townland of Newtown, where my family lived. It was called the Plan of Campaign, very apt because, of course, it was referring to the land agitation time. and one of my own cousins, a man called Finner Houlihan, who frustratingly I've been able to find out very little about, was on the team. But the point I'm making is that clubs were founded maybe 1884, 85, 86, 87. They may not have continually existed since that time, but the tradition was there almost continuously. It has been there for, 230 years now or so, you know.
So it was against that backdrop then, and I suppose the increasing politicisation of the GAA at that point as well, and, you know, aligning themselves obviously through the Irish language to the nationalist cause.
That's right.
And the drive in the early part of the 1900s.
Yes.
It was really against that backdrop, wasn't it, that an amazing man came on the scene all the way from Ballylanders in County Limerick.
That's right. Well, Frank Brazel Dineen, born in 1863, died in 1916. His life really spanned the decades between the Great Famine and the Fenians on the one hand, and the 1916 Rising on the other. Like a great many young men at the time, he was quite well educated. He went to Rockwell College. So he went then to Dublin and he made his career in Dublin. And he was a typical example of the kind of young man that got involved in the GAA, because he was young, well educated. He later worked as a sports journalist. He was one of the most distinguished sports journalists in Ireland. But in his early years, started off as an athlete. And when the GAA was established in 1884, he moved over then to the GAA, and he was such a prominent athlete at the time that the GAA regarded it as a great coup to have actually recruited Dineen. But he then moved really, while he continued to be very much involved in athletics all his life, his main role then was as a GAA administrator. And we've already discussed in an earlier conversation how the rugby administrator, William Lamb Stokes, was a very important figure. And likewise, the GAA administrator was a very important figure. And the interesting thing about Dineen is he was and remains to this day the only person to be both president of the GAA and secretary of the GAA. And interestingly, he actually was president first from 1895 to 1898, and then he was secretary from 1898 to 1901. He, of course, was caught up in all of these rows as well that I mentioned. He was regarded as being a Fenian IRB man and was therefore regarded with some suspicion by the church, although he was a staunch Catholic, of course. But the church didn't like people like the Fenians at the IRB because they regarded them as being subversive. But he was very much caught up in that as well.
So how did a young man, and one of 28 children, Matt, which was really, really fascinated me when
his
I read that.
His father was married three times, yes, yeah. and had a total of 28 children. So Dineen had that. He wasn't short of brothers and sisters in this. He wanted to stick of all around around the back garden himself.
Indeed, I wouldn't like to be queuing for the bathroom in the morning in any case. One of 28 children from Ballylanders. So it was through his exploits as an athlete, obviously, that he came to prominence and then moved to Dublin.
Right.
And another fascinating, just to move the story on a little bit, a fascinating fact that I found, and I didn't know this, was that Croke Park was originally a race course, and he purchased the 14 acres as a race course.
Well, it was actually originally owned by a man called Alderman Morris Butterley. He was a member of Dublin Corporation. And then he sold it on to a group called the... They were the City and Suburban Sports Ground, and they gave their name then to what is now Croke Park. It was situated, of course, on Jones Road, and it was often known as the Jones Road venue. But this particular athletic club, what they got into the habit of doing then was renting the field to the GAA. So a number of All-Irelands were played there, including, in fact, Limerick's first All-Ireland in 1896. It was the second All-Ireland final that Limerick won, which was the 1896 All-Ireland football final, which was played in 1898. It gets a little bit complicated. And that was among the All-Irelands that were staged in Jones Road. As a matter of interest, Limerick's first All-Ireland win, which was in 1887, played in 1888, it was actually played in Clonsky, in a venue there. See, there was no kind of recognised venues really until Croke Park became the recognised venue. And this is where Frank Dineen played a major role. Now, he was no longer an official of GAA when, in 1908, he bought the Jones Road premises himself. And he paid £3,250 sterling for it. He bought in trust for the GAA, and he developed it then over the next few years until in 1913, then the GAA was able to purchase it off him for £3,500. And in the same year then, in 1913, the GAA renamed it Croke Park. So it went from being Butterley's Field to be this city and suburban sports ground to then becoming Croke Park.
And in the intervening time between the time that he purchased it, and of course the GAA couldn't purchase it at that stage because they weren't a recognised entity as such,
correct.
That's why he bought it in trust.
Correct.
He would have done all of the work on it himself and maintained it and paid for all of the developments in it as well, wouldn't he?
He did. He actually, I think his role has been overlooked until very, very recently. So I think very few people, either in Limerick or nationally, were aware until actually around the centenary of these events that he was the person who actually provided the GAA with their headquarters. And as you say, the GAA wasn't set up as a legal entity until 1913, so therefore it wasn't a position to buy the Jones Road property. It was just legally, the GAA was just a collection of individuals. So Frank Dineen bought it on behalf of the GAA, and he spent quite a lot of his own money then on developing it into a decent ground. Now, at this stage, the capacity would have been quite small, a few thousand. But when in 1913 he sold it to the GAA for 3,500, it can be said really that it was a very large sum of money by the standards of the time, but he would have expended a similar amount over the previous years to bring it up to standard. But even after the GAA actually bought what then became Croke Park, Dineen continued to take an active interest in its development.
And of course, Dineen himself didn't really get too long to rest on his laurels in it. He died quite suddenly, pretty soon after that, didn't he?
He died shortly after the Easter Rising. He died in 1916 at the age of 54. Never married. Lived with a relative. According to the 1911 census, he was living with a female relative and with a young man who was described as his valet, which would suggest that Dineen was making quite a lot of money as a sports journalist. But he was the most famous sports journalist of his day in Dublin. And strangely enough, with regard to politics, he had started off as a Fenian, but by the time of his death, he had become quite disillusioned with physical force nationalism, and he had moved over to being a supporter of John Redmond. He felt that the only way to go was to actually campaign peacefully for self-government, which is incredibly ironic because he just died a few days after the 1916 Rising. So, the Fenian dream was to come to fruition. Which he had shared in his younger days. That was to come to fruition in the years after his death.
And the irony continues, doesn't it? Because, he was a forgotten figure for many decades after that, pretty much, apart from his own Ballylanders, where he was obviously remembered. But fast forward then through to more recent times, and, of course, to Sean Kelly becoming president of the GAA. And a relative of Dineen's contacting him, isn't that the way that it happened?
That is correct. You see, Dineen was buried, of course, in, he wasn't married and therefore had no direct descendants, which possibly might have, to some degree, inhibited his memory living on. He was buried in Glasnevin Cemetery, and he was buried in, his grave wasn't marked until comparatively recently. But then in the during the presidency of Sean Kelly, the GAA renamed Hill 16 after him. It's now the Dineen Hill 16. And then, of course, in 2013, the centenary of Croke Park becoming the GAA's headquarters, there was quite a lot of commemoration, including a major event in Ballylanders. A book was launched, written by Harry Greensmith, the well-known GAA historian, on the life and times of Dineen. And there was a seminar held there. And his memory now, I suppose it's still fair to say he wouldn't be a household name in the same manner as Michael Cusick, or indeed maybe of Maurice Davin, who was the first president of the GAA. But I think at last Dineen is becoming better known and is getting the recognition he deserves.
And I suppose the ultimate irony is that a Redmondite now has the name featured on the rubble of Sackville Street, which forms Hill 16 in Croke Park.
That's right. And the other thing is, of course, that the Croke Park, as I say, when it, for example, the capacity for the 1896 All-Ireland, which was played at Jones Road, 3,500. The capacity now of Croke Park, 82,500, the third largest stadium in Europe. The only two that are larger are Camp Nou in Barcelona and Wembley in London. And again, I think that gives you an idea of how the GAA was able to construct this enormous sporting infrastructure, not just in Ireland, but worldwide. And if you think then as well, of course, the other great stadia began to appear not long after Croke Park. I mean, for example, the Cork Athletic Grounds, which was the headquarters of Cork GAA, was 1904, Semple Stadium 1910, and of course our own Gaelic Grounds, 1928. So it is quite a remarkable story how the GAA was able to cover the country with a series of stadia that would compare in size and capacity with many of the large soccer stadiums in the UK, which of course are commercial enterprises for the most part.
And absolutely unique that in all of that there, you know, we still have it as an amateur game, and that an amateur game run by professionals, albeit, is able to manage and look after and build stadia of that size and capacity.
That is correct. And I think someone like Frank Dineen, I suppose he's one of the unsung heroes of the GAA, because as an administrator, he clearly didn't enjoy the sort of glamour of the high profile of the Christie Rings, of the Mick Mackeys, of the Eddie Kerrs of this world. You know, they're the front of house people, really. They're the people that everybody knows about, the players. Everybody goes to see them playing. But the names of this world, they are less well known, because they're backroom people. But without them, they neither the GAA nor indeed rugby with William Lamb Stokes, none of these sporting codes would be able to flourish.
Matt, thanks a million. I think that's been an absolutely fascinating talk today, and I've certainly enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed sitting in the sunshine as well, as always. It's beautiful here in the Markets Field.